way to right itself. This whole forest grew from the ruined dead. This is where the Hungries end up after all their faithful service to the infection that made them what they are. Melanie sees her future and accepts it. But she's not ready to die with so many important things still to be done. She turns and walks back the way she came, following the tunnel of her own cleared path through the crowding grey filaments. Chapter 67. Dr. Caldwell works on through the night, feverishly busy. The fever is literal, and it's currently running at 103 degrees. Extracting the hungry boy's brain takes a lot longer without Dr. Selkirk to help, and Dr. Caldwell's hands are so clumsy that it's virtually impossible to take it out without damaging it. She does the best she can, removing most of the skull in inch-wide jigsaw pieces before she finally screws up her courage and severs the brain stem. When she lifts it out, although her hands tremble violently, it comes clean. She powers up the microtone and takes slices from the brain, choosing cross-sections that will allow her to examine most major structures. She mounts her slides, awed at how perfectly the microtome has done its job. The slices are exquisite, with no crush damage or smearing, despite their ethereal thinness. Caldwell labels each slide, and then examines them in sequence, a virtual tour of the hungry boy's brain, beginning at its base and proceeding upwards and forwards. She finds what she expected to find. The null hypothesis is shot to pieces. She knows what the children are, and where they came from, their past and their future, the nature of their partial immunity, and the extent, close to 100%, to which her own labours over these past 7 years have been a waste of time. She feels a moment of pure happiness. If she'd died yesterday, she would have died blind. This discovery redeems everything, even if what she's found is so bleak and absolute. A sound from close by dynamites her train of thought and brings her instantly to her feet. It's an innocuous enough sound, just a few clicks and whispers. But it's coming from inside Rosie. Dr. Caldwell is not given to excessive flights of imagination. She knows that Rosie's doors are sealed, and that anything powerful enough to open them would have been loud and protracted, alerting her long before this. But she's still trembling a little as she follows the sound forwards, through the crew quarters, to the cockpit. There's a lit-up section of the console, off to the right-hand side, and that's where the sound is coming from the radio. She slips into the seat and leans her head forward to listen. There's not much to hear. Mostly static, pops and hisses and whoops of sound, like the chaos between stations on an ancient analogue wireless set. But a few words stand clear of the aural swamp. Days out from Beacon. Saw your... identify. The voice is hollow, inhuman, warped by echo and distortion. The beam of an electric torch moves quickly across the cockpit's forward shield, and then it's gone again. No sounds penetrate from outside, but she sees movement. Just a shadow, thrown down momentarily by the torch's moving beam. A figure moving briskly down Rosie's left flank. Just a wreck. Think there's any... Caldwell heads quickly for the midsection door. Halfway there, she realises she could have gone out through the cockpit. She stops, turns around, but she knows the midsection door's mechanism better. The sounds from the cockpit radio fizzle and die. With a yelp of alarm, Caldwell runs back to the console and replies on the same channel on which the voice came through.
"Hello?" she cries. "Who's there?" "This is Caroline Caldwell of Base Hotel Echo in Region 6. Who's there?"
Just static. She tries the other channels in turn and gets the same response. She runs through to the midsection again, but when she gets there, she's irresolute. She hasn't applied any e-blocker since the day before, and she can smell her own sweat. If she opens that door, she might bring the Hungries down on herself and her would-be rescuers. The cupboard next to the airlock contains 6 biohazard suits. Caldwell was trained in their use back when she was still on the expedition list, and although it takes her 10 minutes to put one on, she's confident that she's done it correctly. Her scent is completely masked, and her body heat, at least temporarily, contained. When she pushes the door open, she sees nothing moving outside. "Hello?" she calls. She steps out into the street. Nobody. But the light is at Rosie's aft end now, and it's still moving, flicking to left and right. "Hello?" Caldwell says again. Perhaps the suit's helmet is muffling her voice. She walks on shaky legs down the flank of the vehicle, the skin of her neck prickling. She rounds the aft end. The light is in her eyes for a moment. She speaks to whoever is behind it. "My name is Caroline Caldwell. I'm a scientist attached to Base Hotel Echo in Region 6. I'm here with..." The light turns away from her, and Caldwell runs out of words. Nobody is carrying the torch. It's just been attached by its strap to a metal rail on Rosie's rear. It's moving in the wind, not in someone's hands. Fury at the childish trick gives way to the pure terror of realization. This is an ambush. And since nobody is attacking her, the target must be Rosie. The doctor takes to her heels and runs back the way she came, sprinting for the midsection door, expecting a cadre of junkers, or perhaps Sergeant Parks, to burst out from hiding. Except where would they hide? And race her for the prize. Nothing moves. She gets inside and slams the door, engages the lock and the fail-safes, then the airlock for good measure, and then the bulkhead door that seals off the weapons station. Finally, she stops shaking. There's no sound, no sign of anyone. She's safe. Whoever was outside went away and just left the torch. Perhaps it really was a search and rescue team from Beacon. Perhaps they got eaten. Caldwell has no idea, but whatever happens, she's not leaving Rosie again. Not for the siren song of a voice on the radio, not for actual humans showing their actual faces, not for marching bands and ticker tape parades. She walks through into the lab, loosening the seals on the environment's suit helmet as she goes. Melanie is sitting in her chair, in front of the microscope, reading her notes. She looks up. "Hello, Dr. Caldwell," she says politely. Caldwell has stopped dead in the doorway. Her first thought is she alone, or did the others arrive with her? Her second, what can I use as a weapon? The cylinder of phosgene gas is still screwed into place in the airlock's feed chamber. Since she's still wearing the environment suit, she'd be immune to its effects. If she could get to that. "I'll stop you," Melanie says, in the same courteous and level tone, "if you move. I'll stop you if you pick up a gun, or anything that's sharp, or if you try to run away, or if you try to shut me in the cage again, or if you do anything else that I think might be meant to hurt me." That was you?" Caldwell asks her. "On the radio." Melanie indicates with a nod the walkie-talkie sitting beside her on the work surface. "I kept trying all the different channels. It took a long time before you answered. And then?" "Then you..." "I lay down underneath the door. You stepped out over me. As soon as you went past me, I came inside." Caldwell takes off the helmet and sets it down, very gently, on a work surface. A few feet away is the squat bulk of the microtome lathe, an exquisitely engineered guillotine. If she could trick Melanie into walking close to it and topple her onto its cutting bed, this could be over in an instant. Melanie frowns and shakes her head, seeming to guess her intentions. "I don't want to bite you, Dr. Caldwell, but I've got this." She holds up a scalpel, one of the ones that Caldwell used in the dissection of the hungry specimen and hasn't yet found time to disinfect. And you know how fast I can move. Caldwell considers. You're a good girl, Melanie, she essays. I don't think you'd really hurt me. You tied me to a table so you could cut me up, Melanie reminds her. And you cut up Marcia and Liam. You probably cut up lots of children. The only reason I ever had for not hurting you was that Miss Justineau and Sergeant Parks probably wouldn't have liked it. They're not here. And I don't think they'd mind so much now, even if they were. Caldwell is inclined to believe this. What do you want from me? She asks. It's clear from Melanie's agitated manner that she wants something, has something on her mind. The truth, Melanie says. About what? About everything. About me and the other children. And why we're different. Can I take off this suit? Caldwell temporizes. Melanie gestures for her to go ahead. I have to do it in the airlock, Caldwell says. Then keep it on, Melanie says. Caldwell gives up on the idea of retrieving the phosgene. She sits down on one of the lab chairs. As soon as she does so, she realizes how exhausted she is. Only willpower and bloody-mindedness have kept her going this long. She's close to crashing now, too weak to resist this hectoring monster child. She has to gather her strength and choose her time. She's expecting Melanie to interrogate her, but Melanie continues to read the notes, the observations Caldwell has jotted down about her two sets of brain tissue samples, and about the sporangium. She seems particularly fascinated by the sporangium notes, lingering over Caldwell's labelled diagrams. What's an environmental trigger? She demands. It defines any factor external to the sporing body that causes or predisposes towards the onset of sporing, Caldwell says coldly. It's the tone she uses to put Sergeant Parks in his place, but Melanie takes it very much in her stride. Anything outside, she paraphrases. Anything outside the pod that makes the seeds come out of the pod. That's right, Caldwell says grudgingly. Like the Amazon rainforest. I'm sorry. There are trees in the Amazon rainforest that only shed their seeds after a bushfire. The redwood and the jackpine do that too. Do they? Caldwell's tone is brittle. It's actually a perfectly good example. Yes. Melanie sets the notes down. She's looked at each page exactly once, stopped when she got to the front of the stack again. Miss Mailer told me, back at the base. She holds Caldwell's gaze with her unblinking bright blue eyes. Why am I different? She asks. Narrow down the question, Caldwell mutters. Most of the Hungries are more like animals than people. They can't think or talk. I can. Why are there two kinds of Hungries? Brain structures, Caldwell says. But she's at war with herself. Part of her wants to guard the secret, to give away no more than she's asked, to force Melanie to dive deep for every pearl. The other part is desperate to share. Caldwell longs for an auditorium of geniuses, sages both living and dead. She gets a child who's neither, or both. But the world is winding down, and you take what you're given. The Hungries, she says, including you, are infected with a fungus named Ophiocordyceps. She assumes no prior knowledge, because there's no telling what Melanie has understood or failed to understand from those notes. So she begins by describing the family of hot-wiring parasites, organisms that fool the host's nervous system with forged neurotransmitters, hijacking the host's living brain and making it do what the parasite needs it to do. Melanie's questions are infrequent, but right on topic. She's a smart kid. Of course she is. But why am I different? She presses again. What was special about the children you brought to the base? I'm coming to that, Caldwell says testily. You've never studied biology or organic chemistry. It's hard to put this stuff in words you can understand.
Put it in words you understand,
Melanie suggests in much the same tone. If it's too hard for me, I'll ask you to explain it again. So Caldwell delivers her lecture. Not to Elizabeth Blackburn, Gunter Blobel, or Carol Greider, but to a 10-year-old girl. That's humbling in a way, but only in a way. Caldwell is still the one who made all the connections and found what was there to be found, who entered the jungle and brought the hungry pathogen back alive. Ophiocordyceps caldwellia. That's what they'll call it, now and forever. As the sky pales outside, she talks on and on. Melanie stops her every so often with pertinent and focused questions. She's a receptive audience, despite her lack of a Nobel Prize. To the newly infected, Caldwell says, Ophiocordyceps is utterly without mercy. It batters down the door, breaks and enters, devours and controls. Then finally it turns what's left of the host into a bag of fertilizer from which the fruiting body grows. But we were wrong about how quickly the human substrate is destroyed. The fungus targets different brain areas with differing speed and severity. It shuts down higher order thought. It enhances hunger and the triggers for hunger. But we'd assumed that all drives outside of that, all behaviours that didn't serve the parasite's agenda, were embargoed at the same time. When I saw that woman in the street in Stevenage and the man in the care home, I could see that wasn't the case. Both of them were still making connections, haphazardly, to their former lives. They were engaging in behaviours, pushing a pram, singing, looking at old photographs, that were completely without function as far as the parasite was concerned. Caldwell looks up at Melanie. Her mouth is unpleasantly dry, despite the sweat that's running freely down her face. "Can I have a glass of water?" she asks.
"When you've finished," Melanie promises. "Not yet."
Caldwell accepts the verdict. She reads nothing in Melanie's face that would give her room for negotiation. "Well," she says, her voice faltering a little, "that made me think. About you and the other children. Perhaps we'd missed the obvious explanation for why you're so different."
"Go on,"
Melanie says. Her voice is level, but her eyes betray her fear and excitement. It comforts Caldwell a little. In the absence of the physical control she used to enjoy, to have at least this degree of power over her. "I realized that you might have been born with the infection, that your parents might already have been infected when you were conceived. We thought that was impossible. The Hungries couldn't have a sex drive. But once I'd seen the survival of other human drives and emotions, mother love and loneliness, it didn't seem impossible at all. With that in mind, I went back to the cytological evidence. I was fortunate enough to be able to obtain a fresh sample of brain tissue."
"From a boy," Melanie says. "You killed him and cut off his head."
"Yes, I did. And his brain was very different from a normal hungry brain. With the equipment I had back at the base, it was pretty much all I could do to verify and map the presence of the fungus. With this," she indicates with a nod of the head the microtome, the centrifuge, the scanning electron microscope, "I could look at individual neurons and how the fungal cells interacted with them. The boy, here, and the man from the care home, they were so different there was almost no way to compare them. The fungus utterly wrecks the brain of a first-generation hungry. Goes through it like a train. The chemicals it secretes, the brute force triggers that turn specific behaviours on and off, they cause terrible damage as they accumulate. And the fungus is drawing nutrients from the brain tissue too. The brain is progressively hollowed out, sucked dry. In the second generation, that's you, the fungus is spread evenly throughout the brain. It's thoroughly interwoven with the dendrites of the host's neurons. In some places, it actually replaces them. but it doesn't feed on the brain. It gets its nourishment only when the host eats. It's become a true symbiote rather than a parasite.
Miss Justineau said my mother was dead,
Melanie objects. It's almost a protest, as though a lie from Helen Justineau is a thing that can have no place in the world. That was our best guess, Caldwell says, that your parents were junkers or other survivors who'd never made it to Beacon, and that you and they had all been fed on and infected at the same time. We had no model for Hungry's copulating, still less for them giving birth in the wild, and the babies somehow surviving. You must be much hardier and more self-sufficient than normal human infants. Perhaps you were able to feed on the flesh of your mother until you were strong enough to...
Don't! Melanie says sharply. Don't talk about things like that!
But talking is all that Caldwell has left now, and she can't stop herself. She talks about her observations, her theory, her success in working out the pathogen's life cycle, and her failure. There's no immunity, no vaccine, no conceivable cure. She tells Melanie where to find her slides and the rest of her notes and who to give them to when they get to Beacon. When it becomes harder for Caldwell to talk, Melanie comes closer and sits at her feet. The scalpel is still clutched in her hand, but she doesn't bully or threaten now. She just listens. And Caldwell is full of gratitude because she knows what this lethargy that's flooding through her means. The septicemia is entering its final phase. She won't live to write her findings down, to astonish the remaining scientific minds of humanity's doomed rearguard with the spectacle of her clear-sightedness and their idiocy. It's just Melanie. Melanie is the messenger sent by Providence in her last hour to carry her trophies home. Chapter 68. It's a bad night. The room contains nothing except a table and a metal cistern that was once part of the house's central heating system. Every movement makes the bare boards creak loudly, so for the most part, Justineau and Sergeant Parks sit still. Their first visitors arrive about an hour after Melanie pulled the ladder away, a few minutes after she calls them on the walkie-talkie from the wilds of Hackney. Justineau can hear the Hungries stumbling and scrabbling about in the room below, moving restlessly back and forth. The source of the smell, the chemical gradient they're following, is above them, but they can't get up there. All they can do is charge around, driven by eddies of air, random shifts in the intensity of the chemical trigger. Justineau keeps hoping they'll leave, or at least stop moving around, but this isn't like Stevenage. At Wainwright House, the Hungries were drawn by sound and movement. When the signals stopped, they stopped too, waiting for the fungus in their brains to give them further orders. Here, the orders are coming through continually, keeping them in constant, restless motion. At first, Parks opens the trap to peer down at them every so often, shining the light of the torch down into the dark to illuminate their slack, grey faces, upturned, their milky eyes wide and their nostrils flared like the mouths of tunnels. But the view never changes, and after a while he gives up. An hour or so after that, they hear thuds through the walls from whatever rooms are alongside of them. More Hungries, following the scent or the heat trail as assiduously as the first bunch, but betrayed by local geography into going up the wrong stairwell, taking the wrong turn. They're at the centre of a great volume of space, filled with things that want to eat them. No, Justineau corrects herself, not the centre. There's nothing up on the roof. Not yet, anyway. She finds a skylight and climbs up on a table to look out of it. A hunter's moon illuminates the wide sweep of streets southwards towards the river. Fungal froth fills them to the brim and goes on as far as she can see. London is a no-go area, an exclusion zone for the living. Only Hungries can thrive here. God alone knows how far east or west they'll have to trek to get around it. Well, God and maybe Melanie. They try to contact her on the walkie-talkie, but there's no reply and no trace of her signal. Parks thinks it's possible that she's switched to another frequency, although he can't think of any good reason why she'd do that. "You should try to sleep," he tells Justinu. He's sitting in a corner of the room now, cleaning his gun by the light of the electric torch. It shines on the underside of his chin and eye sockets, and most unsettlingly of all, on the diagonal furrow of his scar. "Like you?" Justinu asks laconically. But she climbs down. She's sick of looking at the endless grey escarpments. She sits beside him. After a moment she touches his arm, low down near the wrist. Then with a slight feeling of unreality, she slips her hand into his. "I haven't been fair to you," she says. Parks laughs out loud. "I don't think fairness was what I was looking for exactly." "Still, you got us this far, against all the odds, and for most of the way I've treated you like the enemy. I'm sorry about that." He takes her hand and raises it to head height. She thinks he's going to kiss it, but he just turns it this way and that to let the torchlight shine on it. "It doesn't matter," he says. "Actually, it's probably better this way. I could never respect any woman who had low enough standards to sleep with me."
"That's not funny, Parks."
"No, I guess it isn't. It is okay to call me Eddie, by the way."
"Are you sure about that? It feels like fraternizing."
She's actually angling for the laugh this time, and she's pleased when it comes. Does she want this? She doesn't even know. She wants something, clearly. She didn't hold Parks's hand out of some abstract need for human contact. She held it to see what, if anything, his touch would do to her. But what it does is equivocal. The scar doesn't bother her. If anything, it takes his face out of the category of symmetrical and ordered things to which everybody else's face belongs. It's a face like the throw of a dice. She likes that arbitrariness, instinctively. It's something she's drawn to. What she doesn't like is the cruelties in his past, and in hers, over which she'll have to crawl to get to him. She wishes she'd never told him that she was a murderer. She wishes that she was pristine, in his mind, so that touching him might feel like booting up a different version of herself. But that's not how you get reborn, if you ever can. She pulls out of Parks's grip, then holding his head between her hands, she kisses him on the lips. After a moment, he turns off the torch. She knows why, and makes no comment. Chapter 69. Sometime in the middle of the night, the quality of the sounds from beneath them changes. Up to then it's been random, the thuds and judders of stampeding hungries bouncing off each other again and again in a Brownian cascade. What they're hearing now has a definite rhythm to it, a persistence. There are grunts and clicks and whistles mixed in with the sounds of effort and impact. Hungries don't vocalise. Parks disentangles himself from Justinu's heavy, sleepy embrace and crawls to the trap. He lifts it up and flicks the torch on, already pointed straight down. Framed in its beam is a face out of a nightmare. It seems to leap up at Parks out of the blackness. Dark-eyed, pale-skinned, piebald with dots and slashes of colour, its wide mouth hangs open to display slender, pointed teeth like the teeth of a piranha. Then it really does leap up, reacting to the light with instant murderous rage. Something parts the air in a wickering blur right in front of Parks's face, something that shines in the torchlight and hits the mouth of the trapdoor with a resonant clang. Parks leans back, but he doesn't flinch away from the misjudged blow, so he sees what's happening behind his attacker. Children, boys and girls both, are swarming over the lurching hungries, pulling them down and quickly dispatching them with a range of weapons that's both wide and eclectic. But this isn't what they came for. This is just clearing the ground. They didn't find this place by accident. It's the loft room, and what's in it, that brought them here. The dark eyes flick upwards again and again, locking stairs with Parks. He flings the trap shut again. Justin, who is already stirring, but he pulls her quickly to her feet. "We've got to go," he says. "Now, get dressed."
"Why?" Justin, who demands. "What's..."
She doesn't finish the sentence, because she's heard the sounds from below. Maybe she guesses instantly what they mean. She knows they mean trouble anyway, and she's not so stupid that she'll ask for an explanation that could take up the time they need for an escape. The trap door doesn't have a lock, but Parks manages to topple the metal cistern on top of it. He's barely in time. The trap was already being pushed open when the tank crashed down across it. A shriek from below tells him that whoever was climbing up didn't enjoy being swatted back down. In seconds, the trap is thumping and juddering as the hungry children bring their strength to bear on it. Parks has no idea how they're managing to reach it. Climbing on each other's shoulders, or onto the piled bodies of the other hungries they've just harvested. It doesn't matter. They're too strong and too determined for the cistern to hold them back for long. He jumps up onto the table and thrusts his head out of the window which Justinu has left open. There's nobody up on the roof. He gets his shoulders through and levers himself up onto the slates. Justinu is already following, and although he offers his hand, she doesn't need it. The sloping slates aren't wet, but they're still as slippery as hell. The two of them climb up to the roof ridge with their limbs splayed like frogs, pressing their bodies hard against the treacherous surface. Once they reach the ridge, it's easier. There's a single skin of brickwork making a narrow walkway, so they can stand upright and stumble along like drunken trapeze artists, using the breastwork of chimneys and the pipes of heating vents to steady themselves. Parks is aiming to get to the end of the terrace and find another window to climb in through. Before they're halfway there, loud scuffling and shrill shrieks from behind them warn him that they're no longer alone. He turns to look. Small, limber shapes, clearly defined in the moonlight, are swarming up onto the roof from the room the two of them just left. They're not making for the ridge. They're crab shuffling diagonally towards Parks and Justinu, taking the shortest route to their prey. Parks waits until he reaches the next chimney before he takes out his gun. He fires twice at the closest of the children. The first shot is a direct hit. The kid is slammed backwards, goes tumbling down the slope and over the edge before he can stop himself. The other shot goes wide, but the children scatter, panicked, and another one falls. The rest retreat quickly. Not quickly enough, though. Parks has plenty of time to pick off a few more.
"Don't kill them!" Justinu shouts. "Don't, Parks! They're running away!"
They're changing tactics is what they're doing. But Parks doesn't bother to argue. Better to save the bullets, because they're going to need them when they get to the ground. If they get to the ground. Something hits the brickwork of the chimney right next to Parks's head, and splinters fleck his cheek. From behind chimneys and gables, the hungry kids let loose with what must be slingshots, but with the whiplash speed of a hungry arm behind them, the stones hit like bullets. One of them cleaves the air so close that he can feel it and hear its mosquito whine as it goes by his ear. Enough. He unships his rifle and fires two wide bursts. The first sprays the chimney stacks, forcing the kids back into hiding. The second shatters the slates between him and them on a sweeping, ruinous arc. They'll have a hard time coming across that stretch of roof if they decide to risk it.
"Keep moving!"
he yells to Justinu. He points.
"Down! Down that way! Find a window!"
Justinu is already sliding back down the tiles towards the rain gutter, arms spread to slow herself, feet scrabbling. Parks follows her on hands and knees, facing backwards up the ridge, ready to shoot at anything that moves. But nothing moves.
"Parks,"
Justinu says below him.
"Here."
She's found a window that's not just open, but gone, frame and all. All they have to do is let themselves down from the roof, taking their weight on their elbows, and step off onto the sill. Then it's the work of a second to duck and snake inside. Seconds count now. They've got to make it to the ground before the kids do. Get as good a head start as they can manage. They stumble through the dark, looking for a staircase. That's when the walkie-talkie goes off. Parks doesn't stop, doesn't dare to, but he snatches it up from its holster on his belt and answers. Parks, go.
I heard shots, Melanie says. Are you okay?
Not so much. Justin, who grabs his shoulder, drags him sideways. She's found some stairs. They launch themselves into the lightless well, stumbling and almost falling. He should stop and get the torch from his backpack, but using it would probably just bring the kids down on them more quickly. Some hungry kids found us, he says through panting breaths, armed to the teeth. Kind of like you, only harder to get along with. They're still on us.
Where are you? Melanie asks. Where I left you?
Further. End of the street.
I'm coming to find you.
Good news. Come fast, he suggests. He can tell when they're on the ground floor, because the house's street door is gaping open. They're heading right for it, but the moonlight frames a silhouette as it pops up right in front of them. 4 feet tall, a knife in each hand, ready to carve. Parks fires and the slight shape ducks away. Last bullet in the mag, or maybe second to last. He slides to a ragged, flailing halt. Justinu slams into his back. In full reverse, they head for the rear of the house. Through one mouldering cave after another. The functions of the rooms are impossible to guess and of no damn interest to Parks at all. He's just looking for a back door. When he finds it, he kicks it open and they burst out into what he was praying for. The walled-in wilderness of an urban garden 20 years gone to seed. They dive into head-high brambles, leaving flesh and cloth as tribute. An ululation from behind tells them that the kids are close at hand and still coming. Parks wishes them joy of it. Most of them are bollock naked, so they're more exposed to the inch-long thorns, which are thickest close to the ground. He looks behind. The doorway they just ran through is already lost in the inky dark, but he can see some vague movement back there. He fires into it and something shrieks. Fires again and the slide springs back with a barren click. Does he have another mag in his belt? Is he going to stop and reload in the dark with those cute little moppets climbing right up his arse? A garden wall. Go! Go! He shouts. He boosts Justinu over it, then jumps, misses, jumps again. He finds the top on his third try, and she's hauling him up by the neck of his shirt. Something punches him in the shoulder. Another something explodes against the brickwork next to his hand. Justinu grunts in pain, and she's gone from the top of the wall, toppled as clean as a target on a gunnery range. Park slides over the top and jumps down after her, onto the cracked, weed-choked asphalt of a car park. The remains of a 4x4 lies beside them, its front wheels gone, looking like a steer down on its knees and waiting for the bolt gun to be pressed to its head, the coup de grace. Justinu is down and not moving. He feels her forehead gingerly, and his fingers come away wet. She's no lightweight. But Parks manages to get her up onto his shoulder. He can't keep her there one-handed, though, so it's either run or fight. He runs, then figures out immediately that it was the wrong thing to do. Half a dozen low, lithe forms come sprinting around the side of the house into view, and they don't even slow as they head for him. More are squirming up onto the garden wall and dropping down onto the asphalt behind him. He runs in the only direction he can see that's clear, out into the open, where he's a sitting duck for the slingshots. Right on cue, they start up again. He takes another hit, low down on his back, and it feels like someone punched him in the kidney. He staggers, just about stays upright. And he's tackled, run right off his feet by the fastest of the kids. It launches itself at him in a flying dive, lands on the small of his back and clings there, letting its momentum topple him. Parks goes sprawling, trying to twist his body around under Justinus to cushion the landing, but they part company somewhere along the way. As Parks goes down, the Hungry is already clawing for his throat. He punches it in the face as hard as he can, and it falls away, giving him space to get his foot up and kick it away into midfield. He's doing fine now. Got space enough to grab his rifle and bring it round. Something smashes down onto his shoulder, the same shoulder that took the slingshot stone, with shocking force. The rifle falls from his fingers, but he only knows that because he hears it hit the ground. For a second or two he doesn't feel anything, not even pain. Then the pain rushes in and fills him to the brim. He's sprawled on the ground, the rifle next to his head, and though he's trying to move, nothing very much is happening. His right arm is useless, his right side a barbed wire tangle of complex agonies. The painted kid in the flak jacket kneels at his side. The others are massed behind him, waiting, as he leans in with his mouth gaping wide. From this close-up, there's no doubt about it. Those teeth have been filed. They meet in Parks's forearm. It's the right arm, so it doesn't hurt. There's no free space on that side of his body for new pains to be inserted. But he screams, all the same, as the boy's head bobs back up again, a lump of Parks's flesh gripped raw and bloody in his jaw. This is the signal for the feast to commence. The other kids come skipping in, as though they've been called to a picnic. One of them, a tiny blonde girl, scrambles onto Helen Justinu's chest, grips her hair to tilt her head right back. Parks's left hand finds the handgun tucked into Justinu's belt. He pulls it out and fires, blind. The kid goes spinning away into the dark, the hollow point shell whipping her like a top. The Hungry kids freeze for a moment, startled by the booming report at such close quarters. Into that moment, something new inserts itself. Deafening, terrifying, spitting fire, and screaming like all the demons of hell. Chapter 70. Melanie did her best with the limited materials that were available to her. She advances on the feral children on tiptoe, straining for height, making herself look as little like a girl and as much like a god or a titan as she can. She's naked from the neck down, sky-clad, but she wears on her head the oversized helmet from the environment suit, whose polarized viewplate completely hides her face. Her body is bright blue and glistening, anointed from head to foot with the disinfectant gel that Dr. Caldwell employs, used to employ, in her dissections. In her left hand she carries Miss Justinu's personal alarm, which is doing exactly what Miss Justinu said it would do. 150 decibels of sound hammer the ears and hector the brains of everyone in the vicinity, making clear thought impossible. It's doing this to Melanie too, of course. But at least she knew it was coming. In her right hand she carries the flare pistol, and she fires it now directly at the painted face boy who stole Kieran Gallagher's jacket. The flare shoots right past his head, and the smoke from its passage falls over him, over all of them, like a shawl dropping out of the sky. Melanie flings the personal alarm at the boy's feet, and he takes a step back, flailing at the air as though he's being attacked. She throws herself at him. She doesn't really want to. She wants him to run away from her, because then all the other kids will run too. But he's not doing it, and she's reached him, and she's all out of ideas now. She catches him under the chin with the butt of the flare pistol, a solid blow that snaps his head back and makes him stagger. But he doesn't fall. Shifting his stance, he swings the baseball bat with all his strength. And connects. But he's been fooled by the helmet, which is way too big for Melanie and sitting very loosely on her slender shoulders. He thinks she's 6 inches taller than she is. His devastating blow, which would have staved in the side of her skull if it had connected, ploughs into the top of the helmet instead and whips it right off her head. The boy seems surprised to find she's got another head underneath, and he hesitates, the baseball bat poised for a backhand slash. The sound of the personal alarm is still shrilling in their ears. It's as though the whole world is screaming. Melanie clicks the flare gun a quarter turn, loading another pellet. She shoots the boy in the face with it. To the other kids, watching, it must look as though his face has caught fire. The flare pellet is lodged in his eye socket, shining like a piece of the sun that's fallen to the ground. Smoke pours out of it, straight upwards at first, then breaking into a tight spiral as the boy bends backward from the knees. He drops the baseball bat to clutch at his face. Melanie uses the baseball bat to finish him. By the time she's done, the other kids have finally run away. Chapter 71. Melanie leads the way, and Sergeant Parks comes after, carrying Miss Justineau on his left shoulder. His right arm hangs straight down at his side, swinging very slightly with the rhythm of his walking. He doesn't seem to be able to move it. Miss Justineau is unconscious, but she's definitely still breathing, and there's no sign that she's been bitten. The kids are getting their courage back, a little at a time. They don't dare to press an attack, just yet, but the stones whistle out of the dark to clatter at Melanie's feet. She keeps to the same level pace, and Sergeant Parks does too. If they run, Melanie thinks, the children will chase them, and then they'll have to fight again. They turn a corner at last, and Rosie is before them. Melanie walks just a little faster, so she can get there first and open the door. Sergeant Parks staggers over the threshold and sinks to his knees. With Melanie's help, he puts Miss Justineau down. He's exhausted, but she can't let him rest yet. "I'm sorry, Sergeant," she tells him, kicking the door closed. "There's something we still need to do." Sergeant Parks gestures, left-handed, at the ragged rent in his shoulder. His face is pale, and his eyes are already a little red at the corners. "I have to get out of here," he pants. "I'm..." "The flamethrowers, Sergeant," Melanie interrupts urgently. "You told Miss Justineau there were flamethrowers. Where are they?" He doesn't seem to understand what she wants at first. He meets her gaze, breathing hard. "The wall," he hazards. The fungus stuff." "Yes." Sergeant gets to his feet and stumbles through to the aft weapons station. "You need to power up," he tells her. "I did that before I came to get you." Sergeant wipes his face with the heel of his hand. His voice is a whisper. "Okay. Okay." He points to two toggles. "Primer. Feed. You light the primer. Then you uncap the feed. Then you fire. Jet stays alight until you let go of the throttle here." Melanie stands on the firing platform. She can reach the controls, but she's not tall enough to put her eye to the sights or even to peep over the lower edge of the viewing port. Sergeant can see that she's not going to be able to do this by herself. "Okay," he says again, hollow with pain and exhaustion. She stands down, and he climbs up in her place, stumbling and almost falling off the platform. With one hand useless, firing the flamethrower seems to be a lot harder to do than it was to explain. Melanie helps him, working the toggles while He-Man handles the gun itself. The turret turns with servos, following the movement of the gun barrel, so at least that part is easy. Sergeant targets on the dull grey mass of the fungus forest, which is impossible to miss, because it fills half of the horizon. "Anywhere?" he asks her. His voice is slow and slippery, the way Mr. Whittaker's voice sometimes used to be. "Anywhere," Melanie confirms. "Kid, there's miles and miles of that stuff. It won't penetrate. Not all the way. It's not going to punch a way through."
"It doesn't have to," Melanie says. "The fire will spread."
"I fucking hope so."
Parks leans on the barrel to aim and depresses the trigger.
Fire streaks through the sky, horizontally at first, dipping at the end of its arc to slice through the grey mass like a sword 20 meters long. Filaments that stand directly in the path of the flame just disappear. It's only to the sides that the fire catches and spreads, and it spreads faster than they can turn their heads to see. The fungal mat is as dry as tinder. It seems to want to burn. In the light of the fierce flames, some of the nearer trunks can now be seen even from this far off, straight-edged shadows that shift wildly as the heart of the fire roams like a wild animal through the fungus forest. With more moisture inside them than the filaments, they smoulder and spit sparks for a long time before they catch too and pass from shadow into eye-hurting light. After a full minute, Melanie touches Sergeant's arm. "That should be enough," she says. Gratefully, he releases the trigger. The fiery sword retracts itself in the space of a second, back into the flamethrower's barrel. Sergeant steps down off the platform, his knees buckling a little under him. "You've got to let me out," he mumbles. "I'm not safe anymore. I feels like my fucking head is splitting apart. For the love of God, kid, open the door." He doesn't seem to be able to find it by himself. He turns one way, then another, blinking his bloodshot eyes and grimacing against the light. Melanie takes his good left hand and leads him to the door. Miss Justineau is sitting up now, but she doesn't seem to notice them as they walk by. There's a puddle of vomit at her feet, and her head is hanging down between her knees. Melanie stops to kiss her, very softly on the top of her head. "I'm coming back," she says. "I'll take care of you." Miss Justineau doesn't answer. Sergeant's hand is on the handle of the outer door, but Melanie's hand closes over his, gently, trying not to hurt him, but stopping him from pulling back on the handle and opening the door. "We have to wait," she explains. She cycles the airlock, following the instructions written on the wall right next to the controls. Sergeant Parks watches, mystified. The light goes from red to green, and she opens the outer door. They walk out into a mist so fine, it's like someone laid a lace curtain across the world. The air tastes the same as it ever did, but it feels a little gritty on the tongue. Melanie keeps licking her lips to clear the rime from them, and she sees Sergeant Parks do it too. "Is there somewhere I can sit?" he asks her. He's blinking a lot, and a red tear has leaked down out of one of his eyes. Melanie finds a black plastic wheelie bin and tips it over. She sits Sergeant down on it. She sits herself down beside him. "What did we do?" Sergeant's voice is hoarse, and he looks around urgently, as though he's lost something but he can't remember what it is. "What did we do, kid?"
"We burned the grey stuff. We burned it all up."
"Right," Park says. Is Helen..."
"You saved her," Melanie assures him. "You brought her back inside and she's safe now. She didn't get bitten or anything. You saved her, Sergeant."
"Good," Sergeant says,
and then he's quiet for a long time.
"Listen," he says at last, "could you, kid, listen, could you do me a favour?"
"What is it?" Melanie asks. Sergeant takes his sidearm out of its holster. He has to reach across his body to do this with his left hand. He ejects the empty magazine and gropes around in his belt, until he finds a fresh one which he snaps home. He shows Melanie where to put her fingers, and he shows her how to take off the safety. He chambers around.
"I'd like,"
he says, and then he goes quiet again. "What would you like?" Melanie asks him. She's holding the big gun in her tiny hands, and she knows really what the answer is. But he has to say it so she's sure she's right.
"I've seen enough of them to know."
"I don't want that," Sergeant says. "I mean,
He swallows noisily.
Don't want to go out like that. No offence.
I'm not offended, Sergeant.
I can't shoot left-handed. Sorry. It's a lot to ask.
It's all right.
If I could shoot left-handed.
Don't worry, Sergeant. I'll do it. I won't leave you until it's done.
They sit side by side while the dawn comes up, the sky lightening by such tiny increments that you can't tell when the night stops and the day begins.
We burned it,
Sergeant asks.
Yes.
He sighs. The sound has a liquid undertow.
Bullshit, he groans. This stuff in the air. It's the fungus, right? What did we do, kid? Tell me, or I'll take that gun away from you and send you to bed early.
Melanie resigns herself. She didn't want to trouble him with this stuff when he's dying, but she won't lie to him after he's asked her for the truth.
There are pods, she says,
pointing towards where the fungus wall is still burning.
In there. Pods full of seeds. Dr. Caldwell said this was the fungus's mature form, and the pods were meant to break open and spread the seeds on the wind. But the pods are very tough, and they can't open by themselves. Dr. Caldwell said they needed something to give them a push and make them open. She called it an environmental trigger. And I remembered the trees in the rainforest that need a big fire to make their seeds grow. I used to have a picture of them on the wall of my cell back at the base.
Parks is struck dumb with the horror of what he's just done. Melanie strokes his hand, contrite.
That's why I didn't want to tell you, she says. I knew it would make you sad.
But Parks shakes his head. As hard as it is for her to explain, it's a lot harder for him to understand. She can see that it's hard for him even to frame the words. Ophiocordyceps is demolishing the parts of his mind it doesn't need, leaving him less and less to think with. In the end, he settles for...
Why?
Because of the war, Melanie tells him. And because of the children. The children like her. The second generation. There's no cure for the hungry plague, but in the end the plague becomes its own cure. It's terribly, terribly sad for the people who get it first, but their children will be okay. And they'll be the ones who live and grow up and have children of their own and make a new world. But only if you let them grow up, she finishes. If you keep shooting them and cutting them into pieces and throwing them into pits, nobody will be left to make a new world. Your people and the Junker people will keep killing each other, and you'll both kill hungries whenever you find them. And in the end, the world will be empty. This way is better. Everybody turns into a hungry all at once, and that means they'll all die, which is really sad. But then the children will grow up, and they won't be the old kind of people, but they won't be hungries either. They'll be different. Like me. And the rest of the kids in the class. They'll be the next people. The ones who make everything okay again.
She doesn't know how much of this Sergeant has even heard. His movements are changing. His face slackens and then twists by turns, his hands jerking suddenly, like the hands of badly animated puppets. He mutters,
"Okay,"
a few times. And Melanie thinks that might mean he gets what she said. That he accepts it. Or it might just mean that he's remembered she was talking to him and wants to reassure her that he's still listening.
She was blonde,
he says suddenly.
What?
Mari. She was blonde. Like you. So if we'd had a kid.
His hands circle each other. Searching for a meaning that evades them. After a while, he goes very still, until the sound of a bird singing on a wire between the houses makes him sit bolt upright and swivel his head, left and then right, to locate the source of the sound. His jaw starts to open and close, the hunger reflex kicking in sudden and strong. Melanie pulls the trigger. The soft bullet goes into Sergeant's head and doesn't come out again. Chapter 72. Helen Justineau comes back to consciousness like someone